All right, everyone, thanks for listening to The Rib today on CITR. Sorry, I gotta leave and gotta put on the news. So here's news coming up. Tune in next week.
Today is Monday, May 9th, 2011. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Martin Lovelin. This is CITR News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It's time for a full hour of independent news. Today we will have interviews with BC Liberal, NDP, and Green Party candidates vying for the vacant MLA seat in Vancouver Point Grey. Also a report on the Saturday Slut Walk.
All this, plus FSRN and local headlines, right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news.
But first, headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Neil Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Syrian authorities continued house-to-house raids in Banyas, Homs, on the outskirts of Damascus, and in villages near Daraa today. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says hundreds of organizers and protesters were arrested. A 12-year-old boy was among those killed yesterday in Homs, where tanks moving in residential areas were greeted by a daisy chain of demonstrators. 10 civilians died, ambushed while traveling back from Lebanon. Officials blamed terrorists, but human rights groups refute that claim. And in Yemen, demonstrations also continue to be met with force, with troops and tanks in Taiz, where now at least 3 people are dead during a protest by teachers. Pro-democracy rallies in other cities were also met by violence as protesters continue the call for President Ali Abdullah Saleh to sign the Gulf Cooperation Council-mediated plan to step down. Prime Minister Yusuf Raza Gilani says the notion that Pakistan was in any way incompetent or complicit in hiding Osama bin Laden is absurd. Gilani addressed the nation's parliament today, saying that intelligence failures were the responsibility of all international intelligence agencies around the globe. And he issued a clear warning about future invasions of the nation's sovereign territory.
Any attack against Pakistan's strategic assets, whether overt or covert, will find a matching response. Pakistan reserves the right to retaliate with full force. No one should underestimate the resolve and capability of our nation and armed forces to defend our sacred homeland.
However, The Guardian reports today that the U.S. and Pakistan secretly made an agreement 10 years ago allowing just such an action. The Guardian goes further, saying the agreement between then-President George W. Bush and General Pervez Musharraf would allow the U.S. to, quote, conduct a unilateral raid inside Pakistan in search of bin Laden, and afterwards, quote, Pakistan would vociferously protest the incursion. Land acquisition, or eminent domain, is a major issue throughout India. In Uttar Pradesh, local farmers continue to rally against one such government taking for a third day today. Over the weekend, at least 4 people died in the protests. FSRN's Bismillah Gilani has more.
Farmers in the area have been agitating for several months against a land grab for a highway project. They say authorities acquired their land without their consent and did not pay them adequate compensation. Protesting farmers held 3 government employees hostage and wanted a meeting with the chief minister in exchange for their release. On Saturday, violence broke out when police tried to rescue the hostages. 2 policemen and at least 2 farmers died. Officials claim that protesters opened fire first. The demonstrators deny the charge. They accuse the police of ransacking their houses and damaging their property. Ram Pyari is a local villager.
We have never seen this kind of repression and looting. They came down on us as if we had committed a crime. Is it wrong to demand compensation for our land? Isn't that our right?
Following the weekend clashes, protests have now spread to adjoining areas. The government's attempts to acquire farmland for industries are facing resistance in other regions of India as well. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Israeli nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu is asking the Israeli government to strip him of his citizenship under a recently enacted law aimed at punishing those convicted of espionage or treason. FSRN's Gillian Kessler-D'Amour is in Jerusalem.
In a letter to the Israeli Ministry of Interior released over the weekend, Mordechai Vanunu wrote that he no longer wants Israeli citizenship or to live in Israel. He wrote that he still feels like a prisoner of war and a hostage held by the state and the government. Vanunu was convicted of treason for revealing secrets about Israel's nuclear weapons program to a British newspaper in the 1980s. He spent 18 years in an Israeli prison, of which 11 years were spent in solitary confinement. Since his release in 2004, he has lived under strict conditions, including bans on traveling abroad and contact with foreigners and the media. When contacted by FSRN, Vanunu said he couldn't comment due to these restrictions. Gillian Kessler-D'Amour, FSRN, Jerusalem.
Some 150,000 state employees, including teachers and municipal service workers, will not get their paychecks from the Palestinian Authority this month. The PA says it can't meet payroll because Israel is withholding some $88 million of its dollars in tax revenues. Israel delayed payment due to the PA out of concern about the recent unity agreement between Fatah and Hamas. Residents of Memphis are watching the river flow and rise today. The Mississippi surged over the weekend. Emergency workers went door-to-door in low areas today, encouraging residents to leave. Further south, the Army Corps of Engineers is diverting flow from the Mississippi to Lake Pontchartrain and then onto the Gulf of Mexico. And in New Paltz, New York yesterday, mothers celebrated their Hallmark Day by gathering to call attention to what they say are unsafe conditions at the Indian Point nuclear power plant. A 2008 geological study found that fault lines merely a mile away from the plant could cause a 7.0 quake. Plant officials say the facility is strong enough to bear only a 6.1 tremor. For Free Speech Radio News, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Martin Lemelin. In local news, UBC has joined with organizations around the world in calling for the Syrian government to release journalist Dorothy Parvez. Parvez, who is a correspondent for Al Jazeera English, is from North Vancouver and holds an undergraduate degree from UBC, as well as a master's degree in journalism from the University of Arizona. Parvez entered Syria from Damascus on Friday, April 29, 2011, in an attempt to cover the increasingly brutal crackdown on protests in the country. She has not been heard from since, although her fiancé reported on May 4th that Syrian officials have confirmed that they are detaining her. As UBC professor Peter W. Klein, head of the International Reporting Program at UBC's School of Journalism, said to the Vancouver Sun, quote, "When one journalist is attacked, we're all attacked. Reporters like Dorothy Parvez serve as critical eyes and ears in these hotspots," end quote. Parvez holds passports to Canada, the United States, and Iran. Her story has caught the attention of the world, and awareness is increasing thanks to the popularity on the subject of Twitter and Facebook.
The Mining Association of BC has committed $125,000 over the next 3 years to the First Peoples Cultural Foundation to aid in the renewal of First Nations languages. The funds, which will be put towards documentation and archiving of endangered languages, as well as to overall renewal, come at a time where many endangered languages in British Columbia are in danger of becoming extinct. And it is hoped that the funding contributes will help the FPCF to secure further funding from government partners, says First Nations Cultural Foundation Board Chair Pauline Tesbecht. Quote, Language is the heart of our culture. It is how our elders can teach our young people about the land and our traditional ways. The young people learn these languages are the future leaders of our communities, and they need to understand our past to make the right choices of our future, end quote. It is hoped that these investments in education will add to the success of BC First Nations.
In campus news, UBC has been named Canada's first fair trade campus by Fair Trade Canada. This reflects the fair trade nature of coffee, tea, and snacks sold by vendors operating on campus, in particular those under the AMS. The title Fair Trade refers to the ethical purchase of these goods and the fair compensation that is given to their producers. This honor follows the naming of Vancouver as a fair trade city at this time last year. To be a fair trade campus, Fair Trade Canada asks that only fair trade coffee be sold in campus vendors, and that at least three types of fair trade tea and only one fair trade chocolate options be available as well. UBC was already in accordance with most of these requirements, and it required only small adjustments to meet the criteria. Vancouver-based coffee maker Ethical Bean already supplies the majority of UBC's coffee, with Vancouver-based Milano Coffee pledging to produce its first fair trade coffee blend for UBC as well. UBC joins 100 other universities around the world in committing to making fair trade products a priority on campus.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Slotwatt Vancouver is taking to the Granville Strip Sunday, May 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. Why do we need a slut walk in Vancouver? Because victim blaming and shaming created a culture that makes excuses for perpetrators of assault. Because calling a woman a slut based on her appearance presupposes that women who dress provocatively are worth less and deserve less protection. These two things combined obscure the fact that sexual assault is an equal opportunity offense. All are welcome to join in on the walk and help spread the word. To learn more, visit slutwalkvancouver.com or search Slutwalk Vancouver on Facebook.
Are you interested in radio, but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit CITR.ca for more information.
On May 11th, Vancouver Point Grey will be holding a by-election to fill the MLA seat left vacant by former Premier Gordon Campbell. News 101 reporter Martin Lemlin had a chance to interview three of the candidates running, one of whom is Christy Clark, the newly elected leader of the BC Liberal Party and thus new Premier of British Columbia. Clark currently holds no seat and must win this election to take her place in the BC legislature.
Well, if you live in Point Grey, Kitsilano, or UBC, you're extra lucky. Democratically speaking, that is. 10 days after one of the most exciting federal elections in recent memory, you can cast your ballot in this Wednesday's Vancouver Point Grey by-election. One that's important not only for your representation in legislature, but one that'll also decide whether newly elected Premier Christy Clark has to lead the province from the sidelines. Premier Clark's been hyper-busy trying to squeeze in some campaigning in between her already hectic governing duties. Luckily for us, she was able to spare a few minutes to chat with CITR News last Friday, just before a town hall meeting at St. Mark's Church, where we talked about her difficult schedule, her absence from the All Leaders debate, and even a bit of healthcare reform in there for you. Here is that conversation. Well, Premier Clark, thank you for being with us. How's the campaigning going? Or more to the point, how has it been juggling both the campaign and your responsibilities as Premier?
It's been a challenge. It's kind of like trying to stuff two 14-hour day jobs into 18 hours a day, and so the math doesn't really work, but I'm trying to get it all done as much as I can, so I'm candidate by morning, premier, or candidate at breakfast, premier by morning, candidate again at lunch, premier afternoon and then candidate again at night. So that's kind of the way we're doing it. It's been a real challenge to try and do all of them, though.
It sounds like you'll be glad when it's over.
You know, I like campaigning, though, too, because I'm curious about people, and I like talking to people and finding out about them, and that's what I did as a broadcaster for 5 years. So I enjoy that part. I've enjoyed that part of it a lot. It's just the time crunch that's made this one a little bit difficult.
Well, what have the constituents been telling you that the concerns are in the Point Grey riding?
You know, it's really varied. People are concerned that our government continue our leadership on climate change, which we are. And I think people, that's been really well received. You know, the NDP have taken, NDP opposed that in the last election, opposed the carbon tax, opposed the whole initiative, the green energy initiative that the government took. So I think people are glad that we're going to carry on with that. So I've heard quite a bit about the environment. I've heard quite a bit about, interestingly, crime and safety has been a particular issue, particularly for many people in the Kitsilano end of the community. So that's been on people's minds. You know, some of these ideas like, from my opponent about, you know, he's in favor of polygamy, he's in favor of legalizing illicit drugs, those kinds of things, I don't think they have a big appeal in Vancouver Point Grey. So, and when you if you want to talk to people about crime and safety, those aren't popular initiatives.
Seems odd. The Point Grey ridings are pretty well-to-do neighborhood. I'm surprised that they're so concerned about crime. I didn't think it was that big of an issue over there.
Well, remember, the Point Grey riding is UBC, Point Grey, and Kitsilano. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on in Kitsilano. So it's a really diverse riding with lots of really diverse interests. I've heard a lot about healthcare. I've heard a lot about education. UBC students talking about the need for transit. That's been a big thing for people, for sure. Whether or not it's going to happen, and it's, you know, my response to that is it is in the transit plan. We need to make sure that we consult thoroughly in the community, because there's every reason to have it. It's the biggest transit destination in British Columbia, but we want to make sure that when we make it happen, it's not going to happen in a way that drives a lot of breaks a lot of businesses and makes life difficult for a lot of neighborhoods.
You've given a preference to the phone-in conferences in the town halls rather than attend the all leaders debates. Why did you pass up the debates?
Only because my time has been limited, and it's I'm trying to do these two 14-hour day jobs, and so I had to prioritize what I was going to do. And when faced with the choice of going to an all candidates meeting, which is pretty much politicians yelling at each other in front of a small group of committed voters, and going out and talking to citizens about what was on their minds, and really getting a chance to listen to people about what they'd like me to do on their behalf should I become their MLA, I'm going to choose talking to the citizens, because that's what I need to do in order to be a good MLA for this riding. I don't think you learn a whole lot from yelling at other politicians or being yelled at.
Of course, you have another town hall scheduled for tonight. What are your goals for the town hall tonight? What are you hoping to accomplish?
I'm hoping to hear more of what I've been hearing so far, which is the concerns of people in the riding. So people will get a chance to ask me questions. They'll get a chance to just talk about what's important to them, too. So I'm looking forward to it. We did the telephone town hall, and 2,000 people were on that call. So that's a lot of people to speak with. And I took questions from the group, obviously not 2,000 of them, but as many as we could. And it was a great learning experience for me, and I hope for the people that were on it. So tonight, maybe there'll be a couple more, or, a couple few hundred there, and it's another chance to really engage with citizens. And that's, if you want to be an open government, that's what you want to be doing, is you want to be engaging with citizens, hearing what's on their minds, and trying to find a way to integrate their needs into government actions. And that's, it's a challenge, but I think if you're focused enough on it, you can make it happen.
There's an ongoing debate about sort of the health of our healthcare system. I heard you say earlier that half of BC's taxpayer funding goes towards healthcare already, and there's obviously a problem. How do you think we should address it? Is it a matter of needing more funding, or of spending the money we already have more effectively?
Well, I think I think over the years it's certainly going to be a little bit of both. We have to get smarter about the way we spend money. We have to build new incentives into the system so that our publicly funded healthcare system is using our public money as well as it possibly can there's going to be more money going into the healthcare system. There's just no question about it. But we have to keep it sustainable. That's got to be a real focus for us over the years, because if we don't keep the healthcare system sustainable, we won't be able to continue to provide it at a quality level. So we are very focused on that. I think it is the biggest, single biggest challenge facing any government across the country. So we're starting to grapple with it now. The previous previous administration made some moves, the right moves in that direction, and in, you know, things like moving from block funding to patient-focused funding for hospitals so that they're driven by different incentives. And we've started to find we're bending that cost curve down a little bit. We are actually finding that we're able to make every dollar go a little bit farther. So we want to be able to figure out how we can do more of those things, because our publicly funded healthcare system, many people will say, is almost a part of our identity as Canadians, and it's important to us. So we need to make it sustainable, and we need to protect it.
It seems like there'll always be more problems to fix than there is money to fund the repairs. But as a premier, what do you feel are the two issues that require the most urgent attention other than healthcare?
Well, you know, I would say there's some big, big issues facing government. Our relationship with First Nations is a big issue. There's no question about that. For me, we have to be thinking about how we're going to provide the world's best education system, one that is focused on tomorrow, not yesterday. That's important. And we have to create jobs and job opportunities across the province. And we have to be focused on our resource economy, but we have to be focused on the new economy too, so that there are jobs for people who graduate from high school, graduate from university, that we can really leverage into more economic activity. I mean, that's the future, and that's really what we're focused on. So I've met with the two of BC's university presidents so far, including Stephen Toop, and talked to them about the contribution that universities will make to really kickstarting, sparking up the economy, because I just think there's so much activity we can ignite out there, particularly through some of the innovative work that's going on campus. I think we could really surprise people in the number of jobs that will be created over the next few years.
It's a nice thing to say, but how do you actually go about creating new jobs?
You know what? Government has to be focused, and we have to think about how we're going to try and encourage jobs. So let me give you an example. It's the green economy. British Columbia is now the third most active green economy cluster in the world. Why? Because of government policy. Because the government decided that we were going to pursue clean energy as an economic policy for the province, and it's paid off in spades. So, you know, those are great, environmentally sound, high-paying, innovative jobs in the new economy. So there's a great example of what can happen when you set your mind to it. I have to go. I'm so sorry. Is that okay?
It's absolutely fine. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us, and good luck. Premier Christy Clark is the BC Liberal candidate in the Vancouver Point Grey by-election, which will be held this Wednesday, May 11th, from 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemelin. With only 3 days left before the Vancouver Point Grey by-election on Wednesday, things are starting to heat up. It looks to be a fairly close contest between BC Premier and Liberal leader Christy Clark, but nipping at her heels is NDP candidate David Eby, formerly of the BC Civil Liberties Association and a former law professor here at UBC. David Eby took some time to speak with us this morning, and here's what he had to say. Mr. Eby, thanks for joining us. How's the campaign going? What have the people of Point Grey been telling you that they're concerned about?
Well, the campaign's been going really well, and I think the reason is that the people of Vancouver Point Grey are ready for a full-time MLA. The issues that they're identifying, schools needing seismic upgrading, class sizes being too high, Christie's position lifting the moratorium on supertankers off the North Coast so we can ship tar sands oil to Asia. I mean, these are all major issues for the community, but what's transcended them is the fact that Christie's absent from the riding. She hasn't come to the all-candidates meetings. She hasn't come to the candidates' debates, and people don't know where she stands on the local issues that matter to them. So what it's become about is that they want this full-time MLA. They want someone to be an advocate for the issues they care about.
With regards to the oil tankers off the North Shore and getting rid of them, I'm just curious, because they do serve a purpose. They bring money into not only the province but the country. And I was wondering, if we get rid of the oil tankers that are a big part of the economy, what could we use as an alternative source of income?
Well, let's be really clear about the extent of this project. The project proposes pipeline, an Enbridge pipeline, from the tar sands, where the mining operations are taking place, to the coast, and then these super tankers loading up and taking the oil to Asia. What that's creating is certainly profit, but it's profit for the oil companies that own the tar sands. It's not for the people of British Columbia. There'll be some jobs working the port. There'll be some jobs building the pipeline. But after that, that's kind of it. And so what the NDP is proposing, that we emphasize developing sustainable, real green jobs in British Columbia. We have this Youth Environmental Action Team proposal, jobs for post-secondary students, using carbon tax revenues instead of for tax cuts to banks, using it to create jobs for students to go into our parks and restore habitat, to make sure that our parks are clean and accessible to people so that they're actually useful. Our parks are decrepit, trails are falling apart because of BC Liberal underfunding. So that's just one example. Adding fees to raw log exports. We're cutting down our trees and shipping them elsewhere to be manufactured into products. We've got this really valuable resource. Why are we not making sure that those trees are creating jobs in British Columbia for British Columbians? So we can be green and we can help create jobs in the province. And we don't need to rely on these pipelines and super tankers and the risk of a massive oil spill to do that.
There's a lot of talk about expanding the transit system to UBC, and I know there's a lot of talk about not turning it into what happened on Canby Street. What are the considerations going on with regards to the transit?
TransLink has completed their initial study of the area, and they've come down with a number of fixed proposals. One is a rapid bus lane, sort of up the middle of Broadway Street. One is a light rail, sort of like a streetcar model that would have triggered signals, so it could take up a lane up Broadway as well. And the last is a SkyTrain or RAV line model that would either be tunneled or would be elevated along Broadway. And a couple modifications on those, I'm generalizing. There is a real need for an advisory committee, a community advisory committee, a business advisory committee, to make sure that the model that's chosen serves the community, but also to make sure that the small and independent businesses along Broadway don't get wiped out by whatever TransLink imposes, because the BC Liberals made TransLink anti-democratic. It's no longer elected officials. It's just these appointed officials, and they can do whatever they want without accountability. So whatever they decide to impose, we need to make sure that we're strong advocates to make sure that this transit system does not destroy the independent businesses that we all love along Broadway.
And the revenue from the carbon tax would be able to support that?
Absolutely. Carbon tax revenues, as NDP has proposed, definitely keeping the carbon tax and using the revenue from the carbon tax to fund the majority of the revenue to fund transit initiatives across the province, which would include the Evergreen Line out in Coquitlam, would include the Broadway Corridor and a number of other high-priority transit projects, including buying some buses for TransLink, which is now 1,500 buses behind what it actually needs. So the systemic underfunding of transit is not acceptable, and using the carbon tax intended to reduce carbon emissions for tax cuts for banks and corporations instead of for investing in actually reducing emissions is a major problem, and so we need to deal with that.
Education has been another major point surrounding this by-election. What do you feel are the major concerns surrounding the state of our schools?
Well, there are a couple issues, and of importance to people outside the university community is grade schools and high schools and keeping class sizes down and making sure kids with special needs get the attention they need. So the NDP has proposed rolling back the most recent corporate tax cut. Now, that corporate tax cut makes us the lowest tax jurisdiction in Canada for corporations, which is okay. But we're really not the Alabama of Canada. And for the first 8 years of Liberal rule, we had a tax rate that was competitive. It was in the low middle range, and we were very prosperous with that tax rate. So we're proposing going back to that tax rate and using the revenue generated by that to invest in our education system, to get class sizes down, and to get teacher assistance for kids with special needs. Now, outside of the secondary and elementary schools, we're looking at the universities and we're saying, what can we do for university students? The first thing is creating jobs, 1,500 jobs through this Youth Environmental Action Project for people during their summers, during their course load years when they're at university or college. And the second thing is getting interest rates down and making sure that students can actually, I mean, we're at a stage where students can't even access, and I guess I don't have to tell folks at UBC this, but as much money as they need through the student loan program to pay tuition, books, and to live on. So at a very minimum, our student loans need to match tuition and living expense costs. But more than that, we need to support our post-secondary educations so that they don't have to do things like on these massive housing developments that UBC is doing and that kind of thing, that they're actually focusing on their education mandate. And finally, reintroducing the grant program at the post-secondary level so that students who have low income are able to actually afford to go to school. This is a priority for the NDP as well.
Christy Clark's taken a bunch of flack for not showing up to the All Leaders debates. What was the atmosphere like in those debates? Were people a little bit bummed that she didn't show up?
Well, we had good attendance at both meetings. And at both meetings, people questioned why Christy Clark felt that she could just show up in this riding and expect to be elected without turning up to the community meetings. And they were deeply offended by that. And I think it is affecting her chances very profoundly in this riding. So they were bummed. And, you know, what they were more offended by then after that was Christy's comments in the media, where she said that this was just people shouting at each other, that people already had their minds made up going into the meeting. The meetings were really great discussions about local policy issues and where did each party stand, and very respectful through the whole thing. So I don't know why she would mischaracterize these meetings so badly, but it was very apparent to everybody that she wasn't there and she had no idea what she was talking about, and that has really fed into this ongoing story about her not being available in the community.
Yeah, I understand in the first one there was quite an interesting conversation about democratic reform.
Fair Voting BC raised the issue of the first-past-the-post system, as well as a number of pressing environmental issues, wild salmon. Where did the party stand on aquaculture net pens that are threatening our wild salmon? The BC NDP, of course, in favor of getting those pens out of the water as soon as possible and preserving our wild salmon. Christy Clark getting massive donations from the aquaculture industry and certainly very supportive of, as her predecessors were, expanding that. Lots of important questions asked and answered so that people could get a real sense about where the party stood on them, including, big picture items like proportional representation. So it was a wonderful discussion.
Anything you'd like to add before we let you go?
Yeah, if any of your listeners feel like volunteering, our office is at 3116 West Broadway, and certainly if they're curious about anything, they can stop by as well or visit the website davideb.bcndp.ca.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us, Mr. Eby. Good luck with your campaign. David Eby is the NDP candidate in the Vancouver Point Grey by-election, which is taking place this Wednesday, May 11th, from 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. And to conclude our coverage of Wednesday's by-election, here's my interview with Green Party candidate Françoise René. Françoise, thanks for joining us. How's the campaigning going so far?
It's going pretty well. I mean, I think I've been going door to door, meeting lots of people, and people are very, very supportive of green policy ideas in Point Grey. It's a very environmentally friendly riding. I think that there's a bit of a hesitation because, you know, they're worried that by voting green that they're going to split the vote or something like that. But what I've been telling people is that because this is a by-election, how they vote actually doesn't really make one iota of difference in terms of who's governing the province. The Liberals are still going to be in power, and Christy Clark can even still be premier, even if she doesn't win this seat. So this is actually one of those opportunities where we can vote for something instead of voting against something, which we don't usually get to do in the first-past-the-post system. So.
And what have you found the concerns of your constituents to be?
Well, a lot of people are concerned about the tanker traffic, especially now that we have a Conservative majority government. Like, they want to increase, currently we have 2 tankers a week going through Vancouver Harbour. The Conservatives plan on increasing that tanker traffic up to 10. That's one issue. A lot of people are also concerned about the impact of the Broadway corridor, possible SkyTrain expansion, and nobody wants to see a repeat of what happened on Cambie Street, where they're digging it up and businesses wind up, you know, shutting down because they have no parking spaces and stuff. Education is a huge issue. Our schools are currently horribly underfunded and in need of seismic upgrading, and I work for the school board, so that's something that people are asking me a lot about.
With regards to the tankers, they do bring in money to our economy. What would we replace that with if we got rid of the tankers?
Well, I think that we need to be moving away from oil and gas because, you know, even if you think that it's going to be like the backbone of Canadian prosperity for 40 years to come, the question is, what are we going to do when it runs out? It's a finite resource. You know, somebody once told me that if you build a bridge and you tell people that we're going to spend, you know, billions of dollars to build this bridge and it'll only be good for 25 years, right? people don't want that. They want infrastructure that's going to last us for, you know, potentially 75 years, 100 years. And the fact is that oil and gas infrastructure just isn't going to last that long. So is this really where we want to be investing our funds, or do we want to invest in alternative energy and things that will move us into the economy of the 21st, 22nd century?
With regards to the education funding, what are the major concerns, and how would you go about fixing them?
I think one of the things that's difficult is that because the wage increases that are negotiated, those aren't actually covered by the provincial education budget, so school boards need to pick those up. Also, I think that, class sizes, obviously. We have right now two school buses a day coming from the UBC new housing developments out there. But the problem is that UBC was allowed to develop without building a school. Like, they're going to put one in the next few years. But even still, it won't be enough. There won't be enough spaces for all the new housing that's gone out there. And I think that that's just symptomatic of how our provincial government has been negotiating with the regions. Like, we need to have more decisions on infrastructure and stuff like that happening locally. We don't want to have it all coming from Victoria, because Victoria doesn't have our best interest at heart. And it doesn't make sense that these things are happening without community consultation right now.
So what do you and the Green Party have to offer in the Point Grey riding that maybe the Liberals and the NDP aren't offering?
Well, we have a fundamentally different approach to economic issues than the NDP and the Liberals do. Basically, both the NDP and the Liberals think that, you know, increased GDP, increased GDP growth, increased trade with China and India, increased consumer consumption, that's the way forward, that's how we build a healthy and prosperous economy. But Greens recognize that infinite growth is not possible on a system like ours with finite resources. And we think that it's time to start slowly transitioning to a new future where we have local regional economies that are, you know, steady state, that aren't necessarily growing. Because the fact is, in the 60s and, you know, like the 50s and 60s, GDP growth did do a lot to move people out of poverty and to create employment. But since the 70s, it's really been stagnating. And what's been happening is the increased GDP has actually created more wealth for the wealthiest in society, and it hasn't been generating as much wealth for the rest of us. So, just because we're growing, it isn't necessarily that we're getting better. And we need to start looking at a different economic model.
What do you think is the future with regards to renewable energy?
Well, I think that we need to be moving towards more forms of renewable energy. I think that there's probably a lot of different ways that we can do it. And I think it needs to be more localized, because people need to use the resources that they have at hand. You know, if you're in a sunny area, solar panels make sense. If you're in a windy area, wind power makes sense. If you're if you're on the ocean, maybe it's going to be tidal. We could be using our garbage to create energy for us too, you know. There's lots of different things that we can do, and there's lots of different solutions that we can come up with in different places. The key to successful renewable energy solutions in the future is really regionalizing it, and I think that that's what we need to be moving towards.
The All Candidates debate that took place earlier in the week, how did those go? What did you guys talk about?
Well, there were actually two All Candidates debates that were held this week. There was one on Tuesday night that was hosted by Fair Voting DC. That one was really focused on democratic reform, and it was a really interesting discussion. I think that most of the people on the panel were in agreement about the need to reform our democracy. I would say, however, that the NDP had not come out against the cutting the donations from unions and corporations. I think that that's really a key element of democratic reform, because right now the NDP received $4 million last year from unions, and the Liberals received $13 million from corporations. And when they're earning that much money from outside parties, I don't understand how they're working for us and not for their funders. You know, we didn't even have an election last year. Who are these people, and why were they donating so much to the parties, right? It was because they wanted to influence policy decisions. And on Wednesday night, we had a debate at a Bayview Community School that was very well attended. And obviously, because of the setting and because it was mostly parents from the school, there was a lot of talk about education.
And how do you think people felt that the only candidate not present at the debates was the supposed front runner and premier of the province?
I think that people are incredibly frustrated by Christy Clark's refusal to participate. I think that a lot of people are feeling like she's just, you know, been parachuted into the riding. She's assuming she's going to win. I know as a resident of the riding, I've been getting a lot of communications from her over the last few weeks, talking about what a great job she's doing as premier. And I'm actually worried that, you know, some of that communication might be maybe sidestepping the Elections Act a little bit. I know that there's a spending limit of $71,000 on a campaign, and it seems like she's certainly spent that already, and I don't know where she's getting the rest of her money from.
I know there's legislation in place federally to stop those big contributions from happening, but that's not the case on the provincial level?
I know. I was really surprised by that, too, actually. This is my first... I only just kind of started to get involved politically last year. I started volunteering for the Green Party. I've never run as a candidate before, and I was shocked when I read the Elections BC funding requirements because, you know, I was thinking, like, my father lives in Montreal, for example. He was like, oh, maybe I can donate to your campaign. And it's like, no, that doesn't make sense. Like, why would you donate? You don't live in the province. It seems like there must be something against that. But when I looked into it, there's absolutely no cap on who can donate money, and there's no cap on how much they can donate. So individuals, like just one individual, you know, have donated $200,000 to the Liberals. I could have received $10 million from a Saudi prince, and I'm pretty sure that Elections BC wouldn't have a problem with that.
And then you would be indebted to them, and you'd owe them a favor, right?
Yeah, afterwards, all of my campaign finance will be available for the public record, and anybody who's interested can do what I did and just go to Elections BC and research and see who donated to the Liberals, the NDP, et cetera, last year. And so, yeah, it is publicly available, but the question is how many members of the public are actually going to take that step? I think that what we need to do is we need to put limits, you know, before the election, during the campaign. We need to make sure that politicians aren't subject to outside influence. They should be accountable to the voters. Last year, the legislature only sat for 3 days. That's like 3 days out of 365. And I think that that's just shocking. You know, they're making $75,000 a year to do 3 days of work, and it just doesn't make sense. I think the whole system is really broken, and it needs to be fixed.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we let you go?
I'd just like to tell people in Point Grey that, you know, I'm going to be around next election, too. This is my home. I've lived here since 1979, and I know that a lot of people do support environmental issues and green ideas, and I hope that the people who are currently tempted by the NDP's new green hat that they're wearing, you know, 3 months ago they were against the carbon tax, now they're for it. I hope that they'll remember that the Green Party is consistent and that if I go to Victoria, I will be a consistent voice for the environment. I'm not going to change depending on how the polling results go in the Fraser Valley. You know, to me, this is something that's really important. I have a 2-year-old daughter. Her future matters deeply to me, and I'm committed. I will be here, and I will take their concerns to heart and make sure I'll be the gadfly in Victoria, the one that's, you know, nipping at the heels of both the Liberals and the NDP and reminding them to focus on the priorities that are important to all of us.
All right, well, thank you very much for joining us, and have good luck in your campaign.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot.
And that concludes our coverage of the May 11th by-election with our interviews of the candidates. Don't forget to vote. You do live in the Point Grey area. Vote on Wednesday. It'll be worth it. Back to the newsroom, Iqbal.
This Saturday, there will be a march to open the boundaries of discussion about victim blaming in sexual assault cases. News 101 reporter Martin Lemlin had a chance to speak with Slutwalk organizers Josh Tabish and Kathy Norgren.
For 6 weeks now, a small group of dedicated organizers have been working feverishly, some juggling finals and even writing an honors thesis, to put together Vancouver's version of a movement that started in Toronto. On Saturday, May 15th, thousands are expected to gather in downtown Vancouver to raise awareness and break down boundaries in conversations surrounding sexual assault victims. The name itself has even inspired discomfort in some people. Slut. What does it mean to you? To the organizers of Slutwalk Vancouver, that four-letter word isn't only a means of grabbing your attention. It's a tool expressively designed to make you feel the discomfort of an assault victim. The movement started last month in Toronto, and it's now spread to over 60 cities around the globe, going as far as Amsterdam and Australia. I sat down with two of the Vancouver organizers, Josh Tabish and Katie Norngren, to ask them exactly what it is this is all about. It seemed to me at first like an unnecessary march. Is our society so sick they would actually blame a victim of sexual assault for dressing a certain way? For going to certain places? According to the Slutwalk Committee, that's exactly what's happening.
It seems like such a obvious thing, but you would be amazed at the reaction that people get. I mean, you know, when we talk about assaults that happen in Saudi Arabia or in Afghanistan or something like that, we talk about how it's such a backwards culture and how, you know, it's they don't respect women there, so like they don't have any sort of identity, and that's why that happens. But here, if someone's raped, it's like, oh, well, what did she do to provoke it? You know, it's like, what was she wearing? Was she walking late at night? Was she drinking? Was she doing drugs? Who was she with? You know, so.
How did she make herself vulnerable?
All right, so it seems like our nature is to want to dissect the supposed missteps of victims to find out how a particular scenario could have been avoided. Can a mass march really change the core of the way we think? What is Slut Walk meant to accomplish?
Kind of raise awareness of and start conversations around victim blaming and sex shaming. So there's been a rash of reports recently when we've seen women become victims of sexual assault and rape, there's been a lot of discussion about what it was they did to provoke it, what they ought to do to prevent it in the future, and this kind of march is just about how we're going to change the conversation to get a little bit past that.
Yeah.
And change the, like we like to say, change the conversation from a don't get raped culture to a don't rape culture.
Well, that's fair enough. Seems like a logical move. Start investigating the assailant's missteps rather than the victim's. But Vancouver's a pretty progressively thinking place. Why do we need a slut walk?
Oh, man. I don't know a single woman in my group of friends, in my family, who hasn't been affected somehow by the culture of sexual violence, who hasn't been harassed or assaulted or raped. And it's anything from, you know, someone catcalling you on the street to someone... there's levels of that, and I think everybody is affected by it in some way, shape, or form. And I know that Vancouver has a really large, you know, university, college population. There's a lot of young people here who are, they're certainly not the only people affected, but it's I think probably where the problem is most prevalent. I may be wrong statistically, but this is just my perception of it, that it is... that young people are getting pissed off about it the most. Yeah. And we're realizing now, especially young women in their late teens into their 20s and early 30s, like just that sort of little bit of third wave feminism, that whole I'm so tired of being told that I'm just a slut and not worthy, and I'm sick of the baggage that comes with that. And people are just really fed up.
That seems pretty vague. How about something specific?
On our website, slutwalkvancouver.com, there's a little bibliography of different news stories that have been published around cases of sexual assault and rape, and there's an overwhelming trend that is blaming the victims. There was the story in Saanich. The Saanich Police Department released a statement, and you can go to our website to find more on this, released a statement about a girl who was kidnapped into a car, driven around for several hours, sexually assaulted, and then dropped in a parking lot somewhere after walking through a Saanich neighborhood at about 10:30 at night. And the police officer that commented on it said, you know, every year we see this type of university-aged demographic victim to these types of things. People like this shouldn't be wandering around and making themselves vulnerable, on and on and on. And that was the end of the article. And if you go look, it's there. It's still up on the internet for everyone to see. And I found that really offensive. I just don't think that's as far as the conversation should go. There was no question of, you know, who were these people? Why are these types of things happening? What type of positive alternatives do we have? And then I started looking across all of Canada, and sure enough, there was a story in Winnipeg that was extremely offensive. There were some other stories here in Vancouver.
Okay, so there's obviously some merit to this. What do the people who live here think? How many people do you hope to reach?
The public response has been really overwhelming. I mean, in the first 5 days that we had our Facebook material posted, we had 1,000 confirmed attenders, and as of today, I think we've got about 3,500.
3,500 confirmed attending.
3 weeks later. So 1,000 people or a week are finding this fairly compelling, apparently.
Mm-hmm. What can we expect on Saturday?
We have three pre-walk speakers. We have Vancouver Councillor Ellen Woods-Worth will be speaking. We have a couple of representatives from WAVA, it's Women Against Violence Against Women.
And a representative from Pivot Legal as well.
Darcy from Pivot Legal will be speaking. And during the walk, we have representatives from YouthCo. We have a speaker from the UBC Master's Program. We have...
In English? A woman doing...
Her master's is in basically in rape used as a narrative device in literature, which is what some people don't think about it, but it is actually, it's in so many films, it's in so many books, so it's just like how that reflects in society, and she'll be speaking about that type
of
thing.
And the third speaker is from the BCCLA, which is the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association.
We're very excited to have them on board.
And so they'll be speaking at the three pit stops in the route. We also may have a surprise guest speaker.
The Art Gallery is going to be an interesting place at around 12:30 this Saturday. I'm not quite sure what to expect, but with nearly 4,000 confirmed visitors, there's certain to be something in the air. The organizers of Slutwalk Vancouver are passionately dedicated to opening a forum of discussion regarding any point of view of sexual assault.
The conversation's so one-sided currently. What do women do to prevent violence happening to them? And this march is about kind of complicating that, saying, so what's on the other side? What is the male role in this? And furthermore, what is the lesbian, gay, you know, transgender, you know, what it, I mean, because sexual violence doesn't happen exclusively from men to women. That's another kind of misconception.
And that's really something that we've touched on a lot, is just that this is not a specific men do this to women problem.
But still, couldn't you call it something a little more tame than slut walk?
No, this is not a G-rated issue. This is not some fluffy bunny Disney problem. It is a big issue, and it is a disgusting issue, and people need to think about it.
For more information on Saturday's Slut Walk, visit slutwalkvancouver.com. It's now time for your weekday weather forecast with none other than Iqbal Ahmed.
Thank you for that, Martin. And now for your weekday weather forecast. Today, cloudy with sunny periods, high of 14, UV index 5 or moderate. Tonight, cloudy periods becoming cloudy overnight, low 9. Tuesday, cloudy, 40% chance of showers late in the evening, high of 14. Wednesday, rain, low of 9, high of 11. Thursday, a mix of sun and cloud with 30% chance of showers, low of 8 and a high of 15. Friday, a mix of sun and cloud, low of 9, high of 17. Saturday, cloudy, low of 9, high of 18. And Sunday, cloudy with 30% chance of showers, low of 10, high of 17. Thank you, and that's your weekday weather forecast. All information brought to you by Environment Canada.
That's our program for May 9th, 2011. Today's newscast is brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us on Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of our News 101. I'm Logan Shunk.
And I'm Martin Lumley. Today's show was produced entirely by Iqbal Ahmed. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.